This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. In his new book, journalist Alex Beam lists some of the fads of post-World War II America: the drive-in, the hula hoop, Mexican jumping beans, and the great books of the Western world. A collection of 443 works by 74 white male authors in 54 volumes. Beam says the great books were icons of unreadability. Not only was the type tiny and unreadable, little or no thought had been given to the idea of reading these works for pleasure. Alex Beam tells the story of the great books in A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. Unveiled in 1952 by the University of Chicago and the Encyclopedia Britannica, the books were sold door to door. 1 million sets were sold. Their boosters, Robert Maynard Hutchins, described as Beam as the glamorous, no longer young former president of the University of Chicago. Mortimer Adler, described by Beam as Hutchins' brilliant hobbit-like sidekick, and an ad man by the name of William Benton. Beam calls him a hustler extraordinaire. How did it all begin? Why did people buy the great books? Did anyone read them? How was it decided what to include within the covers of all those volumes? Who made those decisions? And why did the great books turn out to be, like the hula hoop, a fad? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Perhaps your family had a set of the great books of the Western world. What do you remember about them? Were they read? Join our discussion. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. He's the author of two novels and a book of nonfiction, Gracefully Insane, which was a New York Times notable book of 2002. His new book, A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books, is published by Public Affairs. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Alex Beam, thanks so much for spending some time with us this afternoon.
I'm delighted to, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Would you give us some sense of what's between the covers of these 54 volumes?
Yeah. Conveniently, I'm looking at them as I speak to you.
Yeah? You've got a set.
Oh, yeah. I got a set on eBay at the very beginning of this project. I guess about $250, I think. Well, you know, it's extreme left of the set. It's about 5.5 feet long are the Greeks, you know, Plato, Thucydides, Herodotus, Aristotle. That's not the actual order they're in. And then, you move through Ptolemy, sort of early Middle Ages, a lot of astronomy in the middle. I have half of them are facing the other way. And then you get to, you know, 18th century, Voltaire, more science, some 19th century, Gibbons, certainly. Two volumes of Aquinas, totally unreadable, although that was Mortimer Adler was an expert on St. Thomas Aquinas. Kant, Boswell, Darwin, Marx, Tolstoy, and then the last two volumes, 53 and 54, are William James and Sigmund Freud.
Mm.
They're all complete. It's not that they're all the complete works of each author, but they each author is represented by complete works. These are not excerpts like those kind of wonderful books, like the Portable Nietzsche or something. This has like three of Nietzsche's books, in the Nietzsche volume.
Yeah, no, you describe these books as impossible to read. Impossible?
Well, I feel they are, frankly, because I've read many of them. it's a 9-point Pica type, which is very small. They're arrayed in double columns. I was in several great books reading groups where one with Machiavelli's The Prince, and you can just go out and get 50 50 more, you know, easily readable paperbacks of the prints than this thing that, I mean, you know, I'm 55, my eyesight's not what it was. I don't, it's hard to imagine that people would want to use a magnifying glass, you know, to read for pleasure. I mean, Shakespeare, just to take a random example, Shakespeare without footnotes is no picnic. Shakespeare, in double column, small type. I think these are just, you know, beautiful works of literature that normal men and women need a small amount of help reading.
Yeah. Now, given the content and the fact that they're difficult to read, why did they sell so well back in the 50s?
Yeah, well, for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. They launched the set in 1952, and they sold very strongly, basically, throughout the 50s. They were sold by Benton, whom you mentioned was sort of a sales and promotion genius. You know, they were sold as, aspirational tools for both adults and the children of adults, meaning that this was, you know, this sort of represented education. This represented a liberal education, which was, in fact, the term that Robert Hutchins and Mortimer Adler always used when they described the great books. They felt that this was sort of learning in a box, and the context was a little bit different. The notion, you know, I have the statistics in my book, and they don't spring to mind, but many, many fewer Americans had either attended or graduated from college. Obviously, the GI Bill was just kicking in, which would send literally millions of Americans to college. So these kind of also stood in for the notion of, well, so-and-so went to college, she's educated. And this was sort of a product that you could buy that would stand in a way for college education. And secondarily, then as now, parents were very ambitious for their children, and there was I even mentioned some deceptive sales practices, but there was a fair amount of selling these into that space, meaning your 10th grader really should start reading these books to get into college, you know, to have a better job, better interactions with other people.
How did the great books move outside the university into the larger public sphere?
Right. That occurred in the late 30s and the 1940s. They were in a sense they were initially taught by Hutchins and Adler at the University of Chicago, and both men were promotional geniuses, and they got a lot of publicity, curiously. They were really sort of standing American education on its head, and basically where you're sitting became sort of ground zero for the, you know, the extramural great books movement, and people mm-hmm. started writing into Hutchins at Hyde Park saying, you know, we want to start a reading group. And obviously, when we think of reading groups, we think of often of women's reading groups. We think of Oprah's reading groups. But this was in the late 1930s. And people would say, you know, we have a church group. We want to read the great books. So in any case, they found some business people to endow the Great Books Foundation in 1947, which took over this whole outside the university vogue, really. At one point, there were like 4,000 great books reading groups, if I'm not mistaken. And that they're still in the Jewelry Building, right there on the Chicago River. The Great Books Foundation still exists, still encourages and sponsors, you know, great books reading groups all over the country.
Mm. That's a beautiful building, by the way.
Yes, it is a beautiful building.
Well, it's interesting that Fat Cats were first on the bandwagon.
Right. I mean, there's a story there, of course, because Hutchins was a wonderful, brilliant, and very, very controversial president of the University of Chicago. So one of Benton's people said, why don't we take the great books to the University Club, which is also, of course, still in downtown Chicago, where all the trustees, whom you call the Fat Cats, they were basically all rich men, the Swifts and the Marshall Fields. And Benton had the idea of let's have them start a great books discussion group. And curiously, that's how the seed of the whole commercial venture was formed, because Benton felt that they were having trouble getting the books for these titans of finance to read. And Benton had actually bought the Encyclopedia Britannica from Sears just a couple of years earlier. So he sort of correctly saw a commercial opportunity, and he's a very, very aggressive person with very little self-doubt, and he sort of rushed into the breach and declared that Britannica was going to select and publish the great books of the Western world.
Yeah. Benton, quite a fellow, a larger-than-life character. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, Benton, there's a funny Yale connection here, basically. Benton, Robert Hutchins, and a third character who's sort of offstage, Henry Luce, who founded Time magazine and Life magazine, their lives were somewhat interconnected because Luce provided a lot of the propaganda and publicity for the great books. He put Hutchins' face on the cover of Time magazine twice, and he and his wife Claire Booth Luce were always supporters of Hutchins and the great books movement. Benton, when he got out of Yale, started with a guy named Bowles, who I believe is the father of Chester Bowles, although it might have been Chester Bowles himself. I'm a little embarrassed. Anyway, they started the first sort of modern Madison Avenue ad agency, and they they sold toothpaste. They were very modern. He was actually an early investor in Muzak. He wanted to create what then was subscription radio, which was sort of the precursor to cable television. Anyway, he had vowed that if he made $1 million, or he vowed when he made $1 million, he would leave business. And that actually happened by age 30. He left Madison Avenue, and he phoned Robert Hutchins. I think Hutchins actually phoned him. And Hutchins said, you know, come out here to Chicago. I'm doing great things. I mean, your question also implies, I mean, Benton had an unbelievable life after Chicago, after Britannica. He went back to Connecticut, where he was from. He was appointed to an available Senate seat, and then beat George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, beat him in a runoff for the Connecticut Senate seat, and was the first American senator to denounce Joseph McCarthy.
Hmm.
He's an interesting man, very, mm-hmm. very, very brave, and a sort of a business person, intellectual, very, very, very decent guy.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to a couple of the other key figures here in this story. Mortimer Adler, he fell in love with great books when he was a young man, a boy, really, of 15 years of age.
Yes, Adler's an absolutely extraordinary person who wrote two autobiographies during his own very long lifetime. I think he lived to be 98. But there's never been a biography of Mortimer Adler, and I think there's a real opportunity to write a short biography, at least. He was a son. He came from a very, very modest background, lived in Washington Heights in northern Manhattan, and his neighbor had a copy of the Harvard Classics, which was known as Mr. Eliot's 5-foot shelf because they were named after President Charles Eliot of Harvard. And Adler wandered next door, the apartment next door, and started reading the autobiography of John Stuart Mill, which is kind of unthinkable that any 15-year-old would start reading the autobiography of John Stuart Mill, which I've since read, and actually it's pretty interesting. And he was taken aback that Mill, I guess, I tend to get these dates wrong, but something like Mill at age 7 could read and write Greek, was an expert in Greek composition, and had read all of Plato. And Adler himself was no slouch. Adler had no education, had some high school education, but was working as a reporter at the New York Sun, which was a daily newspaper at the time. In any case, he threw over his entire life based on one reading of John Stuart Mill's autobiography, decided he had to get an education, studied at night, passed the entrance exams for Columbia College, and went to Columbia on a full scholarship. And it was actually at Columbia. Adler was undeniably brilliant. Sort of a motor mouth, egomaniacal. Mm-hmm. He described himself in the most unflattering terms possible, and he was always right. But he was definitely brilliant, and he typed out his PhD in one evening. He has this sort of crazy PhD in music theory, because he was expelled from Columbia's philosophy department almost personally by John Dewey, who was considered the greatest philosopher of the era. In any case, yeah, Adler learned to teach the great books at Columbia, where, as I'm sure, you know, as I introduced parenthetically, where the great books are actually still taught to undergraduates. But Adler then teamed up with Hutchins in a very sort of dramatic way. And they did. They became this sort of Mutt and Jeff act in American intellectual history.
Yeah, you call them the odd couple.
Yes, they're definitely. They're very much the odd couple. I mean, Hutchins was really a patrician. It's not that he came from wealth, but, I mean, to use an unfashionable term, but he did sort of come from class. His dad was a Presbyterian clergyman in Oberlin, and Hutchins had gone to both Oberlin and Yale, and he was extremely brilliant. He was tall, he was handsome, and as I've sort of implied, Adler was none of those things. But Hutchins's Achilles heel was boredom. He had a terrible problem. I mean, it's not unique that he was so smart that he was very easily bored. And if Adler was probably the one person on the planet who never bored him, because Adler was just effervescent with and Benton too. I think Benton used to say, "I have 500 ideas a week, and if one of them is worth anything, I consider that a success."
Mm.
They're very, very extroverted, very smart, and in a way, I mean, Hutchins died a very broken and disappointed man, and I think in a way, he probably the high point of his life was interacting with Mortimer Adler at Chicago.
Mm. Interesting. Yet Hutchins had to keep Adler sort of under wraps at Chicago, because he wasn't a popular guy on campus.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. I mean, that gets into some academic politics. Adler's whole life, and some of your listeners will remember Adler. I mean, he published 58 books. He was essentially a popularizer of philosophy, and a successful one. And he also wrote really one of the best-selling books of all time called How to Read a Book, which I think was published in 1947, but it's still in print, first of all. Excuse myself if I have that date wrong. He was a great intellectual popularizer, and I've already mentioned that he clashed with the philosophy department at Columbia. And Hutchins had this notion that Hutchins was appointed to be president of the University of Chicago at age 29, and he had this notion that he was going to bring in a few of his sort of generalist cronies, and that they were going to radically reform undergraduate education at the University of Chicago, and that the grandees who were already at Chicago, the grandees of the philosophy department, the German department, the classics department, were going to welcome Hutchins and his reformers, which of course they didn't, and basically they were all simply just expelled. I mean, the department chairman wouldn't give them spots. Adler was denied a spot at the philosophy department at the University of Chicago, and the two other guys that Hutchins tried to bring in, Scott Buchanan and a man named Stringfellow Barr, were promptly tossed out on their ear, and they stay in my particular story because they went to Annapolis, Maryland to start a small college called St. John's, which also exists to this day and is the only all great books all the time. It has a 4-year undergraduate liberal arts curriculum devoted exclusively to the great books. But Adler was just loathed in Chicago. There's sort of a hilarious moment in my book where he's at the faculty club at the U of C, and he's talking to these Nobel Prize-winning physicists, of which the U of C had many in the day, and he's explaining to them how quantum theory finds an analog in angelology, the medieval study of angels. Which is interesting, but also kind of delirious. And he writes with some asperity about how he was received, which was not very favorably.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Alex Beam, author most recently of A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, why was Hutchins so committed to the Great Books?
It's a good question. he got this call in 1929 from Charles Swift, the president of the Board of Trustees, summoning him, you know, offering him the job of the presidency of the University of Chicago. And with a few, he was already at work on a very complicated legal text with Mortimer Adler. The two had just met. Adler was an expert on the philosophy of the law, among other things. And the two men had a lunch, a famous lunch at the Yale Club in New York. And Hutchins said to Adler, "You know, I'm going to be president of the University of Chicago, but I don't know anything about education." He had been dean of the Yale Law School, and he did know something about legal education because he had reformed the curriculum there. But he didn't have any idea. You know, he's about to take over this great university. And he had no real sort of pedagogical ideology that he'd ever been exposed to. In fact, he was very dismissive of education generally. He always scoffed at his own Yale education. He said, you know, they taught me how to cut up a few frogs. He scoffed at his Yale Law School education. He said they taught me a few opinions of half-literate jurists. And then he had a very unpleasant time teaching at a prep school in Lake Placid where it was a boys' school. None of the boys seemed very interested in anything except passing the SAT, which, of course, fast forwards to our own time. And Adler was the one who had this sort of great books mania, and he just sold it. He sold the whole thing to Hutchins. Hutchins fell in love with the idea of Hutchins, this notion of easily bored returns. I mean, Hutchins really liked to sort of put the spheres in motion and see what happened. So I think he fell in love with the idea of coming to a great research university, really one of America's top five great research universities, and standing the undergraduate curriculum on its head, which is precisely what he did. And I think there was a sort of an outrageous nature to what Adler was proposing that Hutchins found irresistible.
And then was it the two of them at Chicago that began the Great Book Seminar?
Yes, they first taught it in 1930, right after Hutchins arrived on campus. They wanted to sort of explain to the faculty what this course looked like, what this pedagogy was. It was a weekly seminar held around a seminar table, and I think they taught two classes, a total of about 50 boys and girls, and they would discuss one classic text a week in translation. You know, an example would be the Iliad 1 week, the Odyssey next week, Don Quixote the next week. And I guess Hutchins would blow smoke rings and Adler would sort of foam off at the mouth. And that became this odd, Luce started writing about it in Time magazine. It became a media sensation, you know, and Hollywood stars would show up at the class, and it became nationally famous, this one course, which I believe was called General Honors at Chicago.
Yeah, and in the late 40s, then these great books groups were popping up in cities across the Midwest, then beyond. As you say, millionaires, murderers, gorgeous starlets, all of them were cozying up to Aristotle.
Right, that beautiful actress from Creature from the Black Lagoon, Julie Adams, is still alive and still reading the great books. I think her press agent put out a press release sometime in the 50s. That she and her then husband were working their way through Tolstoy or whatever. It was crazy. I mean, it was a genuine vogue, and a very salubrious one, too. I mean, it certainly, you know, beats sniffing glue.
Now, were there critics? Were there people who said, oh, come on now? Were there critics? What were their complaints?
Well, there was essentially sort of, yes, is the short answer. There was a tremendous backlash against the publication of the great books and the great books foundation, the great books reading groups. And it really, I don't go into this too much in, at least I don't cast this particular clash in these terms in the book, but actually it was a clash between Midwestern intellectual values and Eastern intellectual values. And sort of let me explain. I mean, the most vehement critic of the great books for a full decade, and I do quote extensively, was Dwight MacDonald, a very much a dyed-in-the-wool Manhattan intellectual who had access to the New Yorker and cruelly mocked the great books three times in the New Yorker and just sort of despised them. And there was a kind of a... It's funny, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I've lived on the East Coast all my life, and I'd never heard of the great books. And it's funny because I approached a couple of people here at Harvard who had been on advisory committees for the great books back in 1990 or whatever, and they couldn't have been sort of more snide and contemptuous. There's a real looking down your nose, disdainful attitude, basically from, I'd say, the East, you know, originating at the Eastern universities that percolated into the Eastern media, with the great exception, which I've mentioned several times, of the Time Life publications, which, you know, were tantamount to owning all three television networks in the 30s and 40s, because there were no television networks.
Mm-hmm.
So with the exception of, there were other so-called middlebrow publications, certainly Collier's. I mean, there were huge other publications, Saturday Evening Post. Those publications took the great books very seriously. But the kind of Eastern intellectual elite just had no time for, they knew who Hutchins and Adler were, and they really despised them. And frankly, they spat on them. They thought this notion of teaching literature without a PhD, basically teaching literature in at the undergraduate level without appeals to complexity, which is certainly a hallmark of the great books canon. They thought that they held it in complete contempt.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to talk with us, but before we do that, what was the difference between the great books and the Harvard classics?
Yeah, that's a fine question. The Harvard classics came out earlier. They came out in 1938. They were published by P.F. Collier's. One difference was 6 inches. Eliot's so-called 5-foot shelf versus Hutchins's 5.5-foot shelf. And I'll tell you one similarity before I mention a difference. Similarity was that Collier sold a lot of sets of the Harvard classics, and that really resonated with William Benton, because Hutchins was always kind of leery of publishing the great books. You know, he called them colorful furniture, and indeed they are quite colorful. And he said the classics, famous quote was, classics is, you know, by definition, a book that no one ever reads.
Mm.
But Benton knew that Collier's had made a pretty penny publishing the Harvard classics. The only real difference, I mean, I could make the case that there is hardly a difference, but the difference that Adler made much of was that the Harvard classics were excerpts from great works by great writers, whereas the Britannica Chicago, Great Books of the Western World, as I said before, had complete works. I'm not really, I would call it almost a distinction without a difference.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Alex Beam, author of A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I had the same question. What about the Harvard classics? I wondered if I had missed something because we had the 5-foot, not the 5.5-foot shelf books. I was growing up on the East Coast. But everybody was terribly excited about the new president of the University of Chicago, too, being so young and brilliant. So I guess there's a little competition going on around.
Yeah, there's some fascinating stories about Charles Eliot and Robert Maynard Hutchins. I was at a luncheon about 4 years ago, and a person I always held in extremely high esteem named Hannah Gray, who, of course, herself became president of the University of Chicago, was there, and I sat down and tried to chat her up. I was asking her if there was any sort of anything of Hutchins left at Chicago. And somehow we got on the subject of Charles Eliot, and she said Hutchins hated Eliot more than anyone else in the world. And not because of the Harvard classics. It was because Eliot had introduced electives into undergraduate education. And so Eliot was the person who really dynamited the core curriculum.
Well, they were both dynamite. I guess that was true, wasn't it?
They both hated football, which I found out, which is strange. Eliot never had the gumption to get rid of football at Harvard, although I'm sure you know that it's one of his most famous acts as a president. You know, Robert Hutchins, in fact, shut down the U of C Monsters of the Midway, one of the great football programs in America.
Well, it's very interesting to hear you ruminate on this, because it's been in our family quite a long while. I have a brother-in-law from northern Michigan who went to Amherst, but he was taught at SUNY Stony Brook, and anyway, he was very down on sports, so it rubbed off on him from the east to the west,
right.
I don't know, Midwest. Anyway, thanks for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for tuning
thanks
in.
Thanks for the call. And we had another listener who called in who wanted to know, what was the price of the great books if you bought them from a door-to-door salesman?
Right. It's in my book, which is on my lap. I think the price was about $175, but it was payable in $10 a month installments, and there was a lot of fiddling around with the price. The price obviously went up over time. I think the price ended up at about $500 in the 80s, but that's my record. It was never cheap. I mean, if it was $175, it might have been $250, frankly, in 1952. But I mean, it was never cheap, and it wasn't. The installment was positioned as being cheap, the installment plan. But they spent $2 million. That was their budget for creating the great books of the Western world. And sort of unlike some sort of cheapo classics that you can buy at Barnes & Noble these days, they made much of the binding. You know, we haven't even talked about this crazy syntopicon a key part of selling the great books was Adler's crazy notion. Adler, as I said, was a student of Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas was a great categorizer of knowledge and a very much of a categorical thinker. And Adler wanted to create essentially a dictionary of all the great ideas as they occurred in the great books themselves. And so looking at this thing called the Syntopicon, which was a two-volume dictionary of ideas and that were very heavily promoted by the salespeople of the great books. So the notion there was that you could look up justice, and Adler's graduate students would have perused every great book of the Western world and would have citations for you and quotations from every great book where the word or the concept of justice occurred. And Adler thought that the Syntopicon, the notion of an index to knowledge, Adler thought was just a huge sort of contribution. I mean, I think he thought it was a millennial contribution. Mm-hmm. It took $1 million to create the Syntopicon. They employed about 50 people. They famously employed Saul Bellow when he was sort of looking for a way to support his novel writing habit. And the Syntopicon was definitely sort of a marketing tool, but it was also a lightning rod for the kind of criticism I was talking about from East Coast intellectuals, because it kind of, in their view at least, they felt that Adler was kind of showing his true colors, that the notion of Syntopicon was sort of like a Bartlett's quotations and also kind of just a fake digest of all these ideas that no one was actually going to read, say, let's find a great book here. No one was going to read Augustine, you know, but people would use the Syntopicon maybe to quote Augustine on the subject of divine justice or something like that, mm-hmm. that people were just going to use the Syntopicon as kind of a cheap tool for coming across these ideas.
Yeah. We've got about 10 minutes left. I've got two listeners waiting to talk with us. So let's take another call. A listener on line two on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Wonderful program as always. I should tell your guests that I teach at the University of Illinois, and I was struck by the title of his book, A Great Idea at the Time. Does he think it's a great idea at this time?
Good question.
I was talking to my class this morning about when I was years ago in middle school taking Latin, and what a resource it has turned out to be for me, and how I lamented the fact that it wasn't more prominently available, just on general literacy terms and syntax and grammar and so forth. But I think this is one reason why we have problems with cultural literacy now, is that people don't have a common body of knowledge or literature that they can refer to.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do address that at the end of my book because I take a somewhat my book is far from adulatory, where Adler is concerned and Hutchins, and it's far from breezy. I think it was very wide. My book was very widely reviewed, and everyone describes the tone as breezy. And at the end of the book, I felt I owed it to the reader to sort of say what I thought. And I mean, I'm actually on your side, you know, the warmest chapter in my book is actually about St. John's College, which is a real outlier in American education, but does teach a core curriculum of the great books. I have some very warm words for Columbia, which I don't want to pretend to know everything, but Columbia is one of the better known universities. It does require two serious core curriculum courses from their undergraduates. I lament the absolute extinction of the core, and the caller is obviously works in higher education, and I don't. But I mean, I write in the book at least that the core has, for all practical this notion of a core education is for all practical purposes vanished, and we're much the poorer for it.
Amen to that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Alex Beam, author of A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. So what's life like at St. John's for the Johnnies?
Well, I can say you got to read my book because it's funny. It's a great chapter. It's just a warm chapter. It's tough, among other things. St. John's College, there's two St. John's Colleges, one's in Annapolis and one's in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has the highest of freshman washout rate, you know, of any serious college, much, much higher than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, because people, they have a fairly loose admissions policy, frankly, and a lot of the students who get there are essentially self-selected. They're often kind of brilliant misfits, just to lay a tag on them, and St. John's is hard. It's academically demanding, and it's unlike they would claim, and their students whom I interviewed would. It's unlike any college in America because it's about thinking and discussing ideas. It's not about, you know, listening to a lecture and regurgitating the facts back on an exam. And St. John's College graduates, and I quote several of them in my book. I mean, find the world to be a very cold place once they leave St. John's College. Some of them have to go, if they want to be a doctor, they have to go take additional medical courses, additional science courses. And the cold reality of what passes for education outside their walls is a real wake-up call to them.
Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago. I'm getting conflicting information. Let's go line one. Listener...
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
In your book, you tell the story of the mixer at the University of Chicago and the male student was dancing with various women and generally spouting off about the president. And one partner said, "Do you know who I am?" And he said, "No." And she said, "I'm Mrs. Hutchins, Robert Hutchins." He said, "Oh, do you know who I am?" And she said, "No." He said, "Good," and left the dance.
I do not tell that story in my book. I wish I did.
Is that okay? Thanks for the call this afternoon.
That's a reference. I mean, that caller is referring to the astonishing Maud Hutchins, this incredibly beautiful sculptress that and a novelist and poet and
what a beautiful couple they were.
They were a very glamorous and gorgeous couple. Yeah.
Let's take another call now. Now we'll go to a listener in Chicago. Line 4. Hi.
Background on the prolific person of Dr. Mortimer Adler. I had occasion to hear him on the University of Chicago on some lectures he gave, as well as on the radio. I had a program from the Midway that recorded many of his talks, and as well as on WGN with almost every time he wrote a book. So he was very prolific in so many ways. In fact, as a student, he was always at the classroom way before even the teacher came, and virtually bombarded the teacher before the class started with questions, to the point where he apologized to the teacher one day that he wouldn't be able to make it the next day, and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry," with a sigh of relief. But then there was another occasion where he gave a series of lectures on the pursuit of happiness, all of the Declaration of Independence and so forth, and it was a series of 6 one-hour lectures, to the point where when he was finally going over time the hour, because we were recording, the last one, they tied a thin fishing line to the podium and gradually had to pull it off the stage to let him know he's gone over the limit, you know, like they do a hooker on pull a person off of a stage in a vaudeville act. And one other point, in his later years, he began to focus upon some spiritual aspects. I remember he talked about angels and other things, and we got around to asking him what in spiritual matters regarding other parts of the world, like in Asia and so forth. And he said, "No, I've only limited my studies to the Western world civilization." And I think he might have opened up to other aspects, as we all have now, regarding other cultures, if we had heard his views and the studies on the other cultures. Well, I thought I'd mention those little anecdotes. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Yeah,
he was an interesting guy spiritually.
He was a very interesting guy spiritually. That caller bundles in a lot of fascinating facts about Adler, including his Lageria. He would give these famous lectures at St. John's College, where they would they'd have 50 alarm clocks in the auditorium, which would all, he never did stop talking. Yeah, your call is also very well informed. I mean, Adler weirdly he was simply blocked to the Eastern experience, the Eastern way of experiencing the world. He was born Jewish. He was essentially a secular person with a strong leaning towards Catholicism, specifically the Catholicism of St. Thomas Aquinas. And then in Chicago, he worshipped at St. Chrysostom. On the Gold Coast, he was a high church Episcopalian and converted to Roman Catholicism at the end of his life.
We've got one last caller hanging on. Let's go and take that call. Line 2, Muhammad. I can give the listener a minute, and I can give our guest, Alex Beam, a minute. Line 2, hi.
Hi. I'd like to say that Great Books Discussion is not dead in Urbana-Champaign. We've had a group that's been meeting for 40 years. And we meet on the third Tuesday of each month, except for the summer months. And we meet at the Baha'i Center in Urbana, 807 East Green. And our next selection, we're reading from the Great Conversations. And our next selection is Which Era Would That Be? By Nadine Gordimer. If people want to contact me, I'd be glad to tell them all about it.
Okay, very good. Do you want to give us a number over the air?
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Okay.
My name's Shirley. My husband is Aubrey. 586-4640.
Okay.
And we have a great group, very varied people who come. We have great discussions. It was originally started about 40 years ago by Dr. Ray Shepherdson and his wife Jan Shepherdson and Helen Falk, a farmer from Mansfield. And we just have a great time together.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. And that's a great point to end on, isn't it, Alex Beam?
Yeah, I'd like to use my remaining time just to say that you know, I do refer to the afterlife, The Curious Afterlife, the great books. Most major American libraries have great books discussion groups. You know, please go to the website of the Great Books Foundation based in Chicago. They're publishing the Great Conversation series that your caller referred to. It's an astonishing experience. I don't think it's something that, alas, is gaining momentum or adherence, but it's a great pedagogy, and it beats the heck out of Oprah's reading group, I can assure you.
Okay, there we'll leave it. Alex Beam, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Alex Beam is the author most recently of A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. The book is published by Public Affairs.